269. The more a psychologist, a born and inevitable psychologist and analyst of the soul, turns himself towards exceptional examples and human beings, the greater the danger to him of suffocation from pity. He has to be hard and cheerful, more so than another man. For the corruption and destruction of loftier men of the stranger type of soul is the rule. It is terrible to have such a rule always before one's eyes. The multifaceted torture of the psychologist who has uncovered this destructiveness, who once discovers and then almost always rediscovers throughout all history this entire inner hopelessness of the loftier people, this eternal too late in every sense, can perhaps one day come to the point where he turns with bitterness against his own lot and attempts self-destruction, where he corrupts himself. With almost every psychologist, we will see a revealing inclination for, and delight in, associating with ordinary and well-adjusted people. That indicates that he will always need healing, that he requires some sort of refuge and forgetting, far from what his insights and incisions, his trade, has laid on his conscience. Fear of his memory is characteristic of him. He is easily reduced to silence before the judgments of others. He listens with an unmoving face as people revere, admire, love, and transfigure where he has seen, or he even hides his silence while he expressly agrees with some foreground point of view or other. Perhaps the paradox of his situation gets so terrible that the crowd, the educated, and the enthusiasts learn great admiration precisely where he has learned great pity as well as great contempt. Admiration for great men and miraculous animals, for whose sake people bless and honour the fatherland, the earth, the value of humanity, and themselves, those to whom they draw the attention of the young, and whom they use as role models in their education. And who knows whether, in all great examples up to this point, the very same thing has not happened. The crowd worshipped a god, and the god was only a poor sacrificial animal. Success has always been the greatest liar, and the work itself is a success. The great statesman, the conqueror, the discoverer, is disguised in his creation to the point where he is unrecognizable. The work of the artist and the philosopher first invents the man who has created it, or is supposed to have created it. The great men, as they are honored, are small, inferior works of fiction in the background. In the world of historical values, counterfeit is king. These great poets, for example, this Byron, Musset, Poe, Leopardi, Kleist, Gogol, I don't dare mention greater names, but I have them in mind, perhaps have to be the way they are now. Men of the moment, enthusiastic, sensuous, childish, careless, and sudden with trust and mistrust, with souls in which some fracture or other normally has to be concealed, often taking revenge with their works for an inner slur, often seeking in their flights upward to forget some all-too-true memory, often lost in the mud and almost infatuated, until they become like will-o'-the-wisps around a swamp and pretend that they are stars. Then the populace may well call them idealists, often struggling against a long disgust, with a recurring ghost of unbelief which makes them cold and forces them to yearn for gloria, glory, and to gobble up belief in themselves from the hands of intoxicated flatterers. What torture are these great artists and the loftier human beings in general for the man who has once guessed who they are? It is so understandable that these artists should experience from woman, who is clairvoyant in the world of suffering, and who unfortunately also seeks to help and to save far beyond her powers, those easy eruptions of unlimited and most devoted pity, which the crowd, above all the worshipping masses, does not understand, and which it showers with curious and complacent interpretations. This pity regularly deceives itself about its power. Woman may believe that love can do everything. That's a belief typical of her. Alas, anyone who knows about the heart can guess how poor, stupid, helpless, presumptuous, mistaken, more easily destroyed than saved, even the best and most profound love is. It is possible that beneath the sacred story and disguise of the life of Jesus, there lies hidden one of the most painful examples of the martyrdom of knowledge about love, the martyrdom of the most innocent and most desiring heart, which was never satisfied with any human love, which demanded love to be loved and nothing else, with hardness, with madness, with fearful outbreaks against those who denied him love. The history of a poor man, unsatisfied and insatiable with love, who had to invent hell in order to send there those who did not wish to love him, and who finally, having grown to understand human love, had to invent a God who is entirely love, who is capable of total love, who takes pity on human love because it is so pathetic, so unknowing. Anyone who feels this way, who understands love in this way, seeks death. But why dwell on such painful things, assuming we don't have to? 270. The spiritual arrogance and disgust of every man who has suffered deeply, how profoundly men can suffer almost determines their order of rank, his chilling certainty with which he is thoroughly soaked and coloured, that thanks to his suffering he knows more than the cleverest and wisest can know, that he has known and at some point been at home in many terrible far-off worlds about which you know nothing. This spiritual and silent arrogance of the sufferer, this pride of the one chosen to know, of the initiate, of the one who has almost been sacrificed, finds all kinds of disguises necessary to protect himself from contact with prying and compassionate hands, and, in general, from everything which is not his equal in pain. Profound suffering ennobles. It separates. One of the most sophisticated forms of disguise is Epicureanism, and a certain future courageousness in taste adopted as a show, which takes suffering lightly and resists everything sad and deep. There are cheerful men who use cheerfulness because it makes them misunderstood. They want to be misunderstood. There are scientific men who use science because that provides a cheerful appearance, and because being scientific enables one to infer that the man is superficial. They want to tempt people to a false conclusion. There are free, impudent spirits who would like to hide and deny that they are broken, proud, incurable hearts. And now and then even foolishness is a mask for an unholy, all too certain knowledge. Hence it follows that it's part of a more sophisticated humanity to have reverence for the mask, and not to pursue psychology and curiosity in the wrong place.